I am delighted to say that I am joined on the line by economic researcher with SIBTU, Michael Taft. Good morning, Michael, and welcome to Northside Today.
Good morning, Donal.
Michael, you are joining us this morning to discuss the living wage. Now, maybe before we get into the living wage, for the benefit of the listeners, because we hear two phrases when it comes to wages. We hear people's normal wages, etc., etc., but we hear minimum wage and living wage. Could you maybe enlighten us as to what the difference between the living wage and the minimum wage is, please, Michael?
The living wage is actually based on a single person's living costs, and I can get into the detail of that, but it's a living cost measurement. The minimum wage does not take into account living costs. The minimum wage is an estimate by the Low Pay Commission of what is the economy's capacity to pay. So they would especially look at the hospitality, retail, and other low-pay sectors, and they would assess, well, what is their capacity? What is the maximum that they can pay without the threat of loss of employment or loss of economic activity? So the minimum wage is based on capacity. The living wage is actually based on people's real-life experience of living costs, you know?
And is it a case then, Michael, of never the twain shall meet, or is there any move, or is it politically unpalatable, maybe, to bring the two into line?
Well, the living wage for this year is $12.30. The Living Wage Technical Group just released that a couple weeks ago. The minimum wage is $9.80. So there's a difference of €2.50, which is a substantial amount of money. Now, to increase, the minimum wage up to the living wage level would be, it would be something like a 20-25% increase. And many people would argue that that would lead to higher prices. This could lead to job losses. This could lead to business closures. Because so many firms, especially in the domestic sector, the low-paid sectors like hospitality and retail, couldn't afford to pay those wages. That's the argument. Now, I don't think those arguments hold up when we take a broad look at the distinction between the two, and especially when we look at strategies regarding implementing the living wage. But those are broadly the arguments that are made.
And, Michael, we have heard time out a number, and I have seen you eloquently defend living wage and the payment thereof. And I want to come back to that point that you have made. As I said, I have heard you and seen you debate this on various different forums. And any time that there is somebody present, from the small and medium enterprises to any of the, we'll say, the wage payers, this is thrown out straight away as a defence to not paying it. Oh, if we have to bring our pay up to this level, it will mean that we will have to incur redundancies because we only have so much money to spend on wages. Or if we have to give it to everybody, well, then the price of our product will have to rise. Does that argument hold water, Michael?
You know, at some level it does. You know, I mean, I don't think we should just automatically assume that every business that operates can afford a 20-25% pay increase, even if it's phased over a period. But let's take a step back and look what's driving the living wage. I mean, the living wage increased by 40 cents over last year. It was $11.90 last year. It's now $12.30. The single driver, and not the biggest one, the absolutely single driver is housing costs. If housing went up the same level as other payments, as other expenditure, as other consumer items, goods and services, the living wage wouldn't have shifted. It would have still been $11.90 because it's based on living costs. That's what the living wage is based on. What is happening is, and it's been happening ever since 2014 when we first launched the living wage, is that the living wage has been driven by housing costs. Now, rents, because we assess a single person for rents in Dublin, small towns, urban city, other urban cities, and the rural areas. Now, what is the logic of giving people wage increases when all it does is go into one pocket and out the other to the landlord? So in that sense, I think that workers and businesses all have a similar complaint. What they're doing is they're just feeding into higher rents. It's being gobbled up by higher rents. In other words, if the government actually tackled the issue of rents, especially in Dublin, but it's emerging in other areas as well, other urban areas, if they tackled the issue of rent levels, then actually the living wage would fall because you wouldn't have to spend as much of your money on rent. So in that sense, we see, you know, listen, 50% of the living wage in Dublin is made up of rents. Half of a wage is made up of rents.
That's absolutely...
That is unsustainable.
That's absurd, and it's you know, that is, and the word is unsustainable. Now, Michael, can I take you back to an era, I think, which we both would remember? And just to maybe labour that point a little bit, that I remember back in the early 80s when I bought my first house, and I remember sitting down with the man in the building society, and his figures at that stage were as follows. No more than 25% of your monthly income should be set aside for accommodation. If you are spending more than 25%, you cannot afford what you're buying. Does those figures still stack up? And if they do, boy oh boy, have we gone out of kilter.
Well, I mean, first off, that's true. I mean, nobody should be spending more than 30% at a push. 30% at a push. But nobody should be spending, you know, half of their income on accommodation. Unfortunately, as your listeners will know, buying a house in Dublin is, for most people, almost impossible, you know, because of the high level of prices. And we are finding that rents have increased so much that people are now moving out to Drogheda, they're moving out to Meath and Kildare and to Wicklow. And because of that, the two things are happening. One, the rents are going up in those areas now as the rent crisis bleeds out from Dublin into the surrounding areas. And secondly, it's making it environmentally unsustainable. The fact is people have to travel further. This actually costs them in terms of their living standards. You know, there's a difference if you're traveling, okay, an hour to work, going to and from, as opposed to 2 hours, never mind the environmental damage that does. So, yes, I mean, the benchmark of 25-30% is still valid, but we are getting a long ways away because we have an affordability crisis in this country.
And, of course, nothing being done to address that. And as well as that, Michael, I suppose we should maybe hammer home the point on accommodation by saying that, you know, in the times that I'm talking about in the early 80s, I was competing against people in my own sphere and I suppose my own stratosphere in relation to the purchase of a house. Now you're competing for a young couple trying to buy a house at the moment anywhere in Dublin, and indeed I presume the same is true throughout the country at this stage. You are competing against people at your own level. You're competing against the local authorities. You're competing against vulture funds who all want to buy these houses. So it's a restricted market and an increased buyer field.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, we now understand what are called, there's all sorts of these new names that are coming out that we're learning. They're called, we have vulture funds. Now we've come across this thing called cuckoo funds, which means that international, you know, that investors that usually work through REITs, what are called REITs, real estate investment trusts. They buy up a whole complex, which means, and they're just buying it up to rent, which means there's less and less for people to purchase. So that's what's, you know, that not only is that driving prices, but it's also driving the lack of accessibility to even find houses, no matter what the price might be. I would just make this point. There's not a whole lot of competition with the local authorities because the local authorities are doing very little to build any houses. I mean, you know, I mean, if local authorities built more houses, we might be in a slightly better space, but that's not happening. But I just want to return to, because you made the point about, you know, we constantly get this stuff from small business representatives, ISME, Small Firms Association, about how they can't afford wage increases. Well, I do accept the argument that why should anybody in the productive economy pay wages which really don't actually go to benefit the worker but actually benefits the landlord? There, you know, we have to address that issue. I'll just make this point. When the minimum wage first went up, I think it was in 2015, 2016, it hadn't gone up for a decade. It had stayed static a whole decade. It went up by 50 cents, which was a pretty big leap in 1 year. It was $8.65, and then it went up to 50 cents. And, of course, we heard the representatives of business saying, oh, this would close down jobs and do all sorts of terrible things. The fact is the ESRI, a couple of years later, went and assessed the impact on those same businesses, and there was none. In fact, employment in the retail and the hospitality sector has increased since then. Because at the end of the day, employment increases, not necessarily because of wage levels, but the level of demand. If there's higher consumer spending, people are going to spend it on a dinner out. They're going to be spending it in the shops. They're going to be spending it for all sorts of services. That's what determines the health of small and medium-sized businesses in this country who are reliant upon the domestic economy. That's what determines it, not the wage levels. In fact, if you keep the wage levels low, the question is, who's going to buy your goods and services? Who, you know, if you keep the wages low, that means people can't go to a restaurant, can't go to a pub, can't go to a cinema. So I think that we should always take care in listening to the arguments that are put forward by business interests, while also acknowledging that there's a real problem, especially in terms of housing costs.
Yeah, Mike, Lidbus, really what you're talking about there is people's disposable income. And I mean, if they don't have an adequate disposable income, well, then the entire economy suffers. Mike, can I put this to you? Because I know you are a student of the psychological play of money and the effects upon people, because as an economic researcher, you have to be. If people are, now I am posing the question here, so if you can bear with me. If people in employment are getting slightly more, we'll say they're all brought up to the living wage, does that in turn mean that they are happier in their employment? And in turn, if they're happier, that they're more productive? And in turn, if they're more productive, that the actual companies are making more money? Is that a logical conclusion, Michael, or am I living in utopia?
No, that's not only a logical conclusion. That's been confirmed by a number of endless studies, not only you know, throughout Europe, but also in the U.S. Two things happen. One, a higher wage will increase productivity. I mean, I hate this term, you know, a happy worker is a productive worker. You know, it's like, you know, it sounds so reductionist and all that. But the fact is, and I think we all know this, if we really, you know, if we're getting paid, if we feel that our work is being acknowledged, we will go that step further. You know, we feel confident in our work. We feel confident that the employer is appreciating what we're doing, and so we'll work. We'll go that extra mile in the workplace. That's the first thing. So absolutely, there's a benefit from that. Secondly, a higher wage actually reduces turnover. Prior to the crash, the main problem facing small businesses was the issue of turnover, because people felt they weren't getting enough money, and because the jobs market was good back then, unlike, you know, during a period of high unemployment, people could switch jobs. And turnover costs a business. Turnover costs the businesses because they have recruit costs associated with recruiting new workers, training new workers. So if you pay a higher wage, you actually reduce your turnover costs, which in turn reduces the cost of the business. So that's it. Those are, you know, two gains that occur to a business, apart from the fact that now workers have more money to spend, and that doesn't go down a black hole. You know, it does, you know, and especially low paid, they don't save. They don't have enough to save. They go and spend it in the shops and businesses. So, you know, there's a big advantage to businesses for increasing wages.
Well, Michael, the next natural question to follow on from that, in my opinion, is Business 101 operates off the pretext of supply and demand. Now, if, and I use this with capital IF, if we are to believe the figures that are being touted, we are at almost full employment in this country. With that in mind, the shoe has surely now gone on the other foot, in that the power should now be in the hands of the workers as opposed to the companies, so that this would be their opportunity to lever a living wage and the natural follow-on from that. Yes? No?
Yes. That can occur. You may find that workers will move more easily because they know there's job opportunities there, unlike, say, during a recession where there are no job opportunities, so people stay put. You know, they're afraid to try to, you know, to leave their job to go find another. That is the case. But there has been something happening in the economies which is kind of strange and which has puzzled economists. Economic growth has been going on, you know, certainly in Ireland since 2012, in the U.S. a bit earlier, also Europe, but wages are not rising. Usually the idea is that as employment rises, wages start to rise. But that hasn't been occurring. And the supposition, though there hasn't been too much research done here, the working hypothesis, if you will, is twofold. One, workers cannot exert their full power, their full leverage, because there's a reduction in trade union membership. In the past, when trade union membership was higher, workers could bargain collectively for a higher wage. There's less and less of that power now in the private sector. And secondly, so much of the employment gain in Western economies has actually been jobs which are precarious. You know, we think of the gig economy. We think of temporary contracts. We think of part-time work when actually people want to work full-time. And we think of the growth in precarious areas, such as hospitality and retail again, but also construction, where there's high levels of bogus self-employment. So that we're seeing a kind of a strange phenomenon. We're seeing growth at the very top, at the high-income areas, you know, like the big tech companies and financial institutions and, you know, high-end manufacturing. And we're seeing a rise in employment at the bottom, and the middle is being squeezed out. So the problem for policy analysts and for economists in trying to understand it, anybody else as well, is if employment is growing so fast, why is it wages are not keeping pace? And as I said, the two explanations are falling trade union membership, because that refers to power in the workplace, and secondly, the type of jobs that are being created.
Michael, how do we compare with our EU cousins in relation to this?
In terms of
the living wage?
Well, not all countries kind of use the living wage. so it's hard to compare the living wage. What you can do is compare what's called the low pay threshold, how many people are in low pay, and that's about, you know, 60% of your average income. That's a general, you know, that's the benchmark across countries. We have the highest level of low pay in the EU, bar none. Sometimes the UK. I mean, the UK and Ireland are both up there at the top. Very high levels. Over 20% of all employees earn, would be categorized as low paid. But there's other troubling features. Over 10% of employees suffer multiple deprivation experiences, which is what the CSO calls the deprivation rate. And that would be things like, you know, unable to afford to heat your house, unable to purchase a rainproof coat, unable to go out once a month with friends for social reasons. In the worst cases, it's, you know, not having a substantial meal in the last week because you couldn't afford it. So, you know, having a job is not a route out of poverty. Having a job is not a route out of deprivation. As a whole, in terms of our comparison with Europe, Irish workers in the hospitality and retail sector are one of the lowest paid among our peer group. You know, other northern and central European economies, because there's no sense in comparing ourselves to, say, Greece or Romania. These are very poor economies. So when we compare ourselves to Germany, Netherlands, Denmark, Austria, Finland, places like that, our low-paid workers are ultra-low-paid. They're low-paid in relation to our own economy, but when compared to other countries, they are very low-paid.
Michael, what happens when that argument, and I am speaking specifically in relation to the last 2.5 and 3 minutes that you have been speaking to me, what happens when that argument is put to the government and more specifically to the Minister for Finance?
Well, I think there's two things. One, they don't address it. They usually say, oh, well, we have a very high minimum wage. And I'll get into that argument in just a minute. Mostly the argument is that, yes, but this is what we have to do to be competitive. You know, it's that competition argument. The lower the wage, the higher the competitiveness. The higher the wage, the lower our competitiveness. Now, I cannot explain how much nonsense this is. Economies in Europe who have higher wage levels, higher corporate tax rates, higher employer social insurance, and that goes to, you know, funding a number of in-work benefits, like maternity benefits and sickness benefits, they have higher levels of public expenditure. And these economies are ranked higher in competitiveness than we are. So it's very frustrating trying to get across that argument. In terms of the minimum wage, we actually do have a relatively high minimum wage compared to a lot of other countries. But the problem with that is there's not that many on the minimum wage. There's only about like 5 or 6% of workers are on the minimum wage. They're slightly above that. So what you have to do is you have to look at the average pay, especially in the low-paid sectors. And you find that, you find again, as I say, the comparison is that we're very low. And in fact, to show how irrelevant sometimes the minimum wage is, we find in countries like, for instance, take two countries, Denmark and Sweden. There, the wage level in both the retail and hospitality sector is substantially above the average wage here, substantially above. And yet, they don't even have a minimum wage, you know, because it's done through collective bargaining between employers and employees.
And how was there, just as a matter of interest, Michael, and it's probably a very unfair question to ask you, but how was their tourism industries doing?
I wouldn't have thought that Finland or Sweden would get a lot of tourism. I don't think that's a big spot, you know, for tourists. That's true. We have a very high level of hospitality workers here. But again, I'd come back, other countries like France has an equally high level of tourists, you know, the same proportion of tourist visits, much higher level wage in the hospitality sector. Austria actually has the highest level of tourism in the EU. In the EU. Because, you know, a lot of tourists go there for the skiing, and it's supposed to be a beautiful country. A lot of Germans visit there, and Italians and all that. They have a higher wages in the hospitality sector. So it's not affecting their tourism levels. What affects tourism levels is, of course, the quality of the product, the level of prices, and the accessibility of the place.
Michael Taft, economic researcher with SIB2. Michael, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I have been looking forward to this conversation for a long, long time, and we finally got to have it, and I hope that we talk again and that we don't leave it as long, because a rock of common sense and logic, and in a world where a lot of madness pertains, common sense and logic is always very welcome. Michael, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Take care.
Bye-bye now. Thank you.